Good morning. Call the meeting to order. First, we'll have Representative Emmer, if you would, move the minutes.
Can we have a quorum?
Yes.
Oh, great, good.
A quorum is four.
I was absent.
Oh, you were absent, that's correct, thank you. And Representative Dean, would you like to move the minutes of the March 11th meeting?
I'll move.
Thank you. Any questions or comments by representatives on the minutes? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. The minutes of March 11th are moved. We'll begin with Representative Dean on House File 1314.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1314 is a housekeeping bill, and it updates some language.
Representative Dean, would you like to move your bill, please?
I'd like to move House File 1314. And this is a housekeeping bill. The American Board of Nutrition no longer operates as a credentialed body for nutrition profession. That will be replaced by the Board for Nutrition Specialists, so it's just a switch. It has been reviewed. The requirements exceed that of the previous organization. It has 1,000 hours of supervised professional experience. Nutrition-related activities exceeds the requirements found in the statute 148.624. There's no opposition, no amendments to the bill. The asset would be placed on the consent calendar. The director, Lori Mickelson, is here if anyone has any questions.
Mm-hmm. Any members question? Just a quick question. The Nutrition Specialist Organization, a national organization, and how long has it been in existence?
Yep.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Representatives. I'm Lori Mickelson, the Executive Director for the Board of Dietetics and Nutrition Practice. Mm-hmm. The organization that we are recommending for use is the Certification Board for Nutrition Specialists. Mm-hmm. This is a national credentialing organization. Their main offices are in Texas. They have been in operation since the late 80s.
Mm-hmm. And one additional question, how many other states are they used by in terms of being the certification body?
Madam Chair, I believe at this time there's at least 25.
Okay. Thank you very much. And are there any other questions or comments from members? Justin Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Dean, I was going through your bill last night and noticed there were a number of repealers. And I was quite concerned about that. So I studied them and realized that they're obsolete. Thank you.
Anything else?
Okay.
And Representative, you can renew your motion to move this to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee.
So moved.
Okay. Representative Murphy, you had something to add.
Madam Chair, I just had heard Representative Dean suggest that maybe it could go right to the consent calendar. I don't know if we can do that.
No,
but.
We
can't.
Oh.
I saw you pause. But
thank you, Madam Chair.
Looking to staff instruct me on the path. Yeah, okay. 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 And all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It passes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to move on to House File 1366. And in stepping in for Representative Abler today, Representative Aaron Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair and members, Representative Tao is presenting a bill in another committee, and he asked me to step in for him this morning briefly, and I'm really grateful that I'm being joined by someone who's going to know far more about this legislation than do I. So I'd like to begin by moving House File 1366 for recommendation and re-referral to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. And as an opening statement, I would just like to quote Representative Tao and say, this is a good bill, and you should vote for it. And with that, I will turn to my guest. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am Kate Thacker-Pick, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Social Work. And I want to thank Representative Murphy very much for moving the bill forward today. I was expecting Representative Tao to be here, so I'm very grateful. And I'm also want to extend my appreciation to Representative Abler, who's carrying the bill for us. Thanks to the committee for hearing the bill and for the opportunity to testify on House File 1366. As you probably are aware, as a regulatory agency, the board's mission is to ensure public protection by licensing social workers, ensuring that applicants and licensees meet minimum standards for competence, investigating and resolving complaints against licensed social workers in their practice, and we also provide information and education to applicants, licensees, the general public, and stakeholder groups. Excuse me. My brief testimony today will focus on the proposed housekeeping and technical changes to the board's licensing provisions, and I will also briefly summarize the licensing fee reduction, which is included in House File 1366 as well. The proposed changes are non-controversial, and they are supported by the stakeholder groups who were involved in the drafting of the 2007 legislation. The fee reduction proposal has been approved, and it is included in the governor's budget, and it is now included in House File 1571, the appropriations bill. In addition, I've testified before Senator Clark's committee and Senator Berglund's committee on the fee reduction proposal as part of the governor's budget. The goals of the housekeeping proposal are to clarify licensing requirements, to provide a smooth transition into the standards which go into effect August 1st, 2011. The changes, as I said earlier, are non-controversial. They do not create substantive policy changes, and they do not change the scope of practice for licensed social workers. In addition, I've consulted with Mr. Matt Hughes, Governor Pawlenty's policy advisor, who also believes that the changes that are proposed to be housekeeping and technical in scope. A little bit of background. Representative Abler carried the board's bill in 2007, which included increased clinical standards and other licensing standards. Many of the changes enacted in 2007 included a delayed effective date, and that's the August 1st, 2011 date. The delayed effective date was intentional to allow stakeholder groups, especially the colleges and universities, time to comply with the new licensing standards. To allow for the delayed effective date, the revisor's office determined to recodify the board statute in 2007, which resulted in the board's current statute, which is 148D, and the recodified statute, which is 148E, which takes effect August 1st, 2011. Why is the board proposing these housekeeping changes? It became apparent that technical adjustments and clarification was necessary as a result of planning the implementation of the 2007 legislation. In addition, the board is taking the opportunity to, quite frankly, clean up sections within the current statute. Consequently, as you can see from the information before you and the summary that the board has put together, the bill is fairly lengthy and it does contain a number of modifications. There are technical changes to 148D, which are contained in Article 1. There are also technical changes in Article 2 that are specific to 148E, and those are primarily to further clarify the new supervised practice requirements. The fee decrease proposal is in Article 3. The technical changes that are being proposed, as you can see, need to be repeated in multiple sections specific to each of the different categories of licenses that the board regulate. There are supervised practice sections specific to each license. Many sections have few but necessary changes, and while the core licensing requirements enacted in 2007 are not changed, the board believes that this additional detail is necessary to provide greater clarity. A few examples of the proposed changes include necessary technical corrections. For example, there were some citations for cross-references included in the 2007 legislation which were just simply not accurate. There was the creation and clarification of necessary definitions in both Article 1 and 2. There is transition language included, which was recommended by the Attorney General's Office for supervised practice and for continuing education. For example, there's transition language in each section of supervised practice in Article 2, which corresponds to 148E, which clarifies very clearly that supervised practice obtained under the current 148D will continue to meet requirements. There's transition language that clarifies when the increased CE hours take effect. There's also an increase in terms of the current independent study hours that are allowed. That increases that from 10 to 15 in the overall requirements. The 4,000 hours of clinical supervised practice for the LICSW remains unchanged. Mm-hmm. It is still 4,000 hours of clinical supervised practice that is required for the clinical license, but there is a modification being proposed. So that would allow licensees who are practicing in a less than full-time capacity to be able to satisfy all requirements for the clinical license in no less than 4,000 hours, but no more than 8,000 hours. The section that is specific to the LISW, supervised practice requirements in 148E, does contain a fair amount of new language. But again, this was a housekeeping change. When you look at 148E 110 as enacted in 2007, the language clearly states that the LISW who is engaged in clinical practice must maintain supervision for a specified amount of time. It also is very clear about who that supervisor must be. But what is lacking, as we were reviewing things, it neglects to identify the number of supervision hours required. It neglects to identify that the individual needs to submit a plan to the board that is required of all other licensees required to obtain supervised practice. And so this new language was inserted into this section, again, for greater clarity and to have everything in one place. Again, it does not change the policy in a substantive way. The technical changes will provide greater clarity for both licensees, applicants, the general public, and the board as these new licensing requirements take effect. And lastly, I will just quickly review the board's fee proposal because it is included in House File 1366. The board's current temporary fee reduction sunsets June 30th of 2009. That has been in effect since January 2006. Now, even with the current reduced fee rate, revenue has consistently exceeded expenditures. And there are two primary reasons for this. there has been a gradual increase of licensees over the last two biennium, which has resulted in an over-collection of fees, quite frankly. And in addition, the board's ongoing commitment to streamline and reduce expenditures has resulted in lower expenditures. And in particular, the board has experienced great success with our online services, including online renewal applications, online license applications, and online license verifications, which have resulted in over 30,000 hits to our website in less than 3 years to verify the current license status of our licensees. The board and its finance committee gave very careful consideration to planning this biennial budget and determined that to maintain the current reduced fees with the additional 10% reduction was warranted and is still fiscally responsible. The board is able to maintain operations even with these reduced fees. The fee decrease has been welcomed by stakeholder groups. Probably don't even need to say that. It's been very well received. And again, the goal for the board is to be fiscally responsible and comply with the state regulations that requires us to balance revenues and expenditures. In conclusion, the housekeeping changes are necessary to clarify our licensing requirements and to provide a smooth transition for applicants and licensees and the public when the new licensing requirements take effect in 2011. Thank you for your consideration, and the board asks your support of House File 1366. And I would be happy to take any questions the committee might have. Thank you.
Any members, questions, or comments? Mr. Emmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first page of the bill refers to, under the definition of body art. What's that?
We're not on the body art bill.
What are we
we're
doing?
On
I
the
thought we were doing tattoo.
No, that's that's two down the agenda still. But we'll be ready to listen to you then. Thank you.
Well,
this
never
is
mind. Words of Gilda Radner, or no wonder I didn't like this.
Yeah. Well, it's early still. The chair is also finding that the caffeine hasn't kicked in yet. So, anyways, anybody else?
Question or comment?
I have a general question and one specific within that umbrella. And that is the issue of, would you clarify whether or not any of the changes proposed in this legislation increase the threshold, either educationally or supervision, time length, or type of supervision, relative to the changes that done in 2007 that are being phased in under the 2011? And in particular, under that, the in Article 1, Section 2, Subdivision 6B talks about graduate degree. If you could explain to the committee what that change involves. And I can read the words, but I don't know what it's taking the place of necessarily. So what's the purpose of that and what the change actually involves?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and members of the committee, if what you are referring to is the definition for graduate degree that is included, again, in Article 1, this is housekeeping in that the academic degrees which qualify for a master's level social work license would include two different types of degrees. Because there are two different types of degrees, in order to hopefully make this a bit simpler, rather than specifying a master's and a PhD, those were combined into a graduate degree rather than always making two separate references throughout the bill. And the graduate degrees then would include a master's degree in social work, which is accredited by the National Accrediting Body for Social Work Curriculum. And the other degree that will qualify under the graduate degree definition is a PhD in social work from an accredited university.
Mm-hmm. Let me follow up into that in terms of, has anything changed? Let me say it this way. Are there current practitioners, either with master's or PhD, who would not meet the terms of this language and that their degrees were not granted by these by programs accredited by these organizations? And if so, if the answer is yes, is that taken account of in the language of the statute?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the two degrees that I specified, the accredited MSW degree and the PhD degree in social work, have been the two graduate level degrees that have qualified for social work licensing at all times except during our initial grandparenting period, when non-MSW degrees but accredited master's degrees and other related disciplines were also accepted by the board.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a very time-limited portion very early on.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from members?
On this
bill. Mr. Murphy, would you like to... renew your motion to move this to the Health and Services Policy Committee.
Oh, Madam Chair and members, Representative Powell is going to be here today for Representative Abler. This is actually Representative Abler's bill, so I think in his words, we've pulled the people together and tried to work something out so we can move something forward, and I hope you can support this. And I would like to renew my motion that you adopt House File 1366 with recommendation and send it to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee.
Thank you. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All those opposed? And the motion is passed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're going to, we were debating whether to recess or pause.
Let
because
me do that last one over again.
just for those in the room, representation cannot be here until 9:15. Representative Howe is in another committee hearing giving another bill that he's up on. We are going to go see if he's ready or within minutes of being ready. No. We need staff is checking to see if Representative Powell will be here imminently, and if not imminently, we will then recess and wait for Representative Thiessen. Those listed here, Mr. Pansiera, and are you are with Representative Thiessen still? Can you identify yourself?
Yes.
And are you the primary proponent who's worked with him on this bill, or are you just a testifier?
Okay.
Okay. Okay, and would you be in a position to kind of fully present testimony on this even if Representative Thiessen was not here, or would you prefer that we definitely wait for his presence?
I think I could present, yes. I think
okay.
There's a couple of amendments.
And are those amendments that Representative Thiessen is fully aware of? Okay. We'll wait to the staff for 1 minute, and then Representative Murphy, would you be willing to sit in again today?
Someone else
can
have
an
amendment.
Oh, okay.
Representative
Hammer
and
Representative Change my name. We're going to wait for 1 minute until staff returns.
Hammer.
Yeah. He goes, I don't think there's any danger to that.
That's what I told her. She had a whole bunch of people around her, but I really appreciate it. And I did. She's a great lady. But I can make you one for her. I know I'm calling to her. You're not going to be at work.
We're going to go ahead with Representative Thiessen, Phil. So would either you'd like a volunteer? I think in the spirit of bipartisanship, we'll have Representative Dean move the bill for us up there. We understand that Mr. Representative Thiessen will be here very shortly. So, Representative Dean, you'll be, I think Representative Thiessen will be here very soon, I've understood, prior to the earlier estimated time. So if you could just move the bill for the committee, please.
Madam Chair, members, I'd like to move House File 249 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health Policy and Fine, or excuse me. Oh, here he is.
There you go. You are up, Representative Thiessen.
You can go ahead.
Finance. And,
okay. No, Representative Thiessen, he's actually moving your bill for you at the moment.
Mr. Pansier is here to describe it, but since Representative Thiessen is here as well, perhaps we'll let him.
Thank you.
Did you have any opening comments, Representative Thiessen, or would you like to move to Mr. Pansier? We are in House
File. Can we move it to amendment?
249, yes. Thank you. We have movement. That's right. We need to move the amendment. Thank you. Okay. I'm going to find her in order. Okay. There it is. Okay. Representative Thiessen, would you like to move your A1 amendment?
Someone has to do it for me.
That's right, sorry. I will move the A1 amendment to House File 249.
And this, Madam Chair, deletes most of the bill and then just makes some technical changes, really, to make the first paragraph clear. It makes breaks into subdivisions.
Do you want to provide any explanation why we're deleting most of the bill?
No.
Okay.
But just to make it easier on everybody.
Okay. Okay.
It's not worked out.
Okay. Okay. Any questions for Representative Thiessen or Speaker on the A1 amendment? Okay. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. You want to proceed with your A2 amendment?
Please.
Mm-hmm. I move the A2 amendment to House File 249. Any comments on the amendment?
Madam Chair, this relates to the second section of the bill, mm-hmm. which adds a psychologist to the Health Care Reform Review Council that was set up last year, mm-hmm. and it just is requiring that the appointment be made by October 1st, 2009.
Any questions from members? Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment passed. And then to the bill.
And Madam Chair, I would just, I think, just to testify or to speak to the bill.
Mm-hmm. Good morning, Madam Chair and Representative. My name is Lawrence Pansiera. I'm a licensed psychologist and a member of the Minnesota Psychological Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Psychological Association in support of House File 249. House File 249 has three provisions. They're non-controversial. The first authorizes psychologists to provide the final determination that services provided by psychologists are not medically necessary or clinically necessary. This will give patients more prompt notification as to whether or not services have been approved by their managed care organization, and it will also reduce costs to such organizations, which currently pay psychiatrists to do these reviews, and psychologists cost less to the organization and psychiatrist. The second provision of the bill adds a psychologist to the Health Reform Review Council. The reason for this is that this would assure that there is at least one member on the review council that has an expertise in mental health and in the behavioral aspects of health promotion, disease prevention, and disease management and treatment. Under the current definition for the membership, none of these things would automatically be provided to the council. Third, the House File 249 clarifies that the practice of psychology involves, at times, the discussion of physical illnesses and conditions and medications. The practice of psychology has always recognized the need to integrate mental health and substance abuse care with general medical care. This bill makes explicit the long-standing practice of discussion of medication with clients, and it is important to do so because of the growing emphasis on integration of mental health and medical health care. And because of the largest national accreditation organization, the Joint Commission is now requiring psychologists to participate in a process known as medication reconciliation, which does, in practice, require the psychologist to review medication with their clients. All these elements that I've reviewed, the three provisions to 249, add the safety and quality of healthcare services for the people of Minnesota. And the Minnesota Psychological Association is proud of the role the psychology has played in serving Minnesota for over 70 years. And we are pleased to support this bill.
Mm-hmm. Any questions or comments from members? Kathleen Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning. Can you just talk to me a little bit more about the practical impact of the amended, like the new language in line 3.10, mm-hmm. including the psychological impact of medications. Can you just help me understand a little bit better the problem that you are trying to address and how this solves that?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, my understanding is that because psychologists obviously do not prescribe medication, and that is not within their competency in their profession. The issue was becoming unclear about how that psychologists appropriately, within their competency, would be able to discuss medication and even talk about dosages with clients. So it's an attempt to make very clear the current area of competency so that question gets clarified.
There was, Madam Chair, there was some concern among some psychologists that the way that this is written, that they couldn't actually discuss the psychological effect of medications with their patients. So this doesn't expand any authority to actually prescribe. And I don't really think it actually expands the scope of practice. It's more clarifying language than anything else.
And Madam Chair, and Representative Keeser, to the testifier, you know, I did have a call from a psychiatrist from the district I represent, worried about this, trying to understand if it was an expansion. I just wanted to make sure and clarify from your perspective that it's not, that it is. It's just trying to clarify what is the current practice.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, this is only talking about what is currently being done, and through this process we have consulted with the Psychiatric Society and the Medical Association, the Minnesota Medical Association, to make sure that it's clear in the minds of all the stakeholders, all the participants in the system, that this is just a clarification of current practices.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other members? Somewhat along those same lines, I have a question regarding the change that's in 1.19, 1.20. You just mentioned regarding Representative Murphy's questions that you had spoken with the Psychiatric Association. In terms of this change, has there been comments or views expressed by psychiatric associations or by the medical association?
Madam Chair, committee members, once again, we did consult with them. We made it very clear to them, and they appreciated that this has only to do with the practice of psychology and the role of the approving psychologist. And given the nature of the system, the way it works now, they had no problem with that clarification change.
Mm-hmm. And we amended the language, in, Madam Chair, in fact, to kind of address, to make that even more clear. So mm-hmm. with the amended language, this applies for review when the psychologist is the treating provider.
Okay, so that's part of what that language is. Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay. We'll renew my motion.
Okay.
Sorry. We do have one more testifier on this legislation, James Klein. Good morning. State your name for the record.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Klein. I live in Minneapolis. I am a private citizen not representing any organization here this morning. I have an avid interest in psychology and have been a finalist for non-professional positions reserved for non-professionals on both the Board of Psychology and the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy in the recent past. I have copies of my remarks if it pleases the Chair to have them distributed mm-hmm. to the committee. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking in favor of this bill and will restrict my comments to Section 3, and I believe almost specifically to some of the concerns that the representative raised just moments ago. Mm-hmm. Section 3 amends the definition of practice of psychology. Point 4 of the definition relates to the meets and bounds of the term psychotherapy and presently includes, as its fourth subpoint, the diagnosis and treatment of the psychological aspects of physical illness or condition, accident, injury, or disability. The bill would add to this the clause, including the psychological impact of medications. This addition will accomplish two very important objectives. The first is that it will incorporate into the statute a clear and unambiguous statement that a licensed psychologist is permitted to be actively engaged with the client on matters relating to medications and their psychological effects and side effects, and to treat such side effects in appropriate ways up to but not including prescription privileges. Mm-hmm. The second is this.
No licensed psychologist is required by the statute to engage in all of the activities encompassed in the definition of practice of psychology. In fact, licensed psychologists are forbidden to take part in any such activities around which they have not acquired competence. For example, one cannot ethically practice a form of psychotherapy for which one has received no training. This bill will make it clear and unambiguous that if a licensed psychologist does engage in the diagnosis and treatment of the psychological impact of medications, such practice must be competent and carried out ethically, and it makes it clearly possible for the Board of Psychology to regulate such practices, such practice via rules, and to take disciplinary action for unethical or incompetent diagnosis and treatment of the psychological impact of medications. But more simply, the bill will empower LPs to counsel clients about the effects of their medications, and it will empower the board to insist that LPs who choose to do so must do it well. This is a win-win for the public. Why is it important? One of the most common, if not the most common, psychological diagnoses in our time is that of depression. There is widespread agreement that the best course of treatment for depression is a combination of at least one of the many antidepressant pharmaceutical medications available today and one of the many available forms of talk therapy. The prescription, of course, must be obtained from a medical doctor. Typically, this will be a psychiatrist or one's family practice doctor or some other general practitioner. Most psychiatrists these days do not additionally practice any of the talk therapies, and of course, no family practice doctor should be doing so. So the reality for most folks is that their treatment must involve both an MD for prescriptive purposes and an LP for psychotherapy. It is also a reality that the client's patients will see the prescribing MD anywhere from once a month to once every 6 months, and that these appointments may be as brief as 15 or even 10 minutes. It is common for the same client, however, to be seeing the licensed psychologist for an hour every week, or perhaps even more frequently. The LP is uniquely situated to be the professional monitor of the effects and the side effects of the medications that the MD has prescribed, provided the LP has appropriate training and continuing education. I have come here to testify today because I have personal experience of the problems that can ensue today because we lack such a clear clause in our statute. 10 years ago, a member of my extended family sought treatment from an LP. The therapeutic relationship was a good and productive one for the client. After some months, however, the LP began to urge strongly that the client consult an MD psychiatrist for a prescriptive consultation. One of the antidepressant pharmaceuticals was prescribed. At just about the normal time for the medication to take effect, 4 to 6 weeks, the client began to exhibit one of the known side effects of this particular medication, impulsiveness. The LP both mistook the behaviors driven by drug side effects for previously unmanifested symptoms in the client, and also appears to have believed that only the MD could be involved in further diagnosis of those symptoms. The LP then panicked, began down a path that ultimately resulted in the destruction of the therapeutic relationship between the client and the LP, the destruction of the therapeutic relationship between the client and the MD, and ultimately the loss of this LP to the profession through loss of license. I have simplified the story, of course, in the interest of time and protection of privacy for all involved. Many additional factors were involved, but we believe to this day that this LP was otherwise competent and effective. Not recognizing drug side effects and not knowing clearly what options were available when those side effects appeared had psychological costs for the client, psychological costs for the LP, and ultimately costs to the public in the form of the loss of a fine practitioner to the profession. Section 3 of this bill will not make this scenario an impossibility, but it is a necessary first step to minimizing its likelihood. And I strongly encourage you to pass House File 249.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Do any of the representatives have members have questions for Mr. Klein or comments? Do the previous testifiers have any comments for the author? Okay. If there are no further questions or comments, I will renew the motion to pass House File 249 as amended to Health and Human Services Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the motion passed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to have Mr. Ryan Wells come up. Also, reports everyone else that he operates in a good time. It just came up. He said we could. He said we could. He has them. Yeah. Okay. Members, we're going to start in just a moment. I want to make 2 points. Representative of Saikow is going to be here shortly. He's on his way in just a moment. Secondly, under state statute 214.02, state law requires that if there's a significant change between unregulated to license or further advanced stages of regulations between unregulated on its way to licensing, that the proponents of the regulation are to complete a report under Chapter 214.02. It involves 11 questions that they're supposed to provide responses to, and it's to be given to the two standing committees in the House and Senate. The report is available this morning, and it was copied and just distributed to you just now, I believe. Is that right? Yeah. So you just received that. So it's numbered 1 to 11. Says at the top 214.02 and evidence in support of tattoo regulation. So the questions, you don't have the questions. I have the questions, so I will pass out the questions as well. So I will pass out there the copy of that section of the statute so you have the questions that they're answering in those points 1 to 11. Okay. I thought there was. Okay. I'm going to move House File 677 to pass and move and proceed to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. We do have an amendment, but we won't address the amendment until Representative Tao arrives, and he can move his amendment at that time and explain the amendment to us. But we will start. I understand that, Mr. Wells, that you are a primary opponent involved in the developing of the bill. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. So I'll let you introduce yourself and then proceed with the general background for the bill and your testimony as we're waiting.
My name is Ryan Wells. I'm from Duluth, Minnesota. I've worked in the tattoo industry for over 10 years in northern Minnesota, upstate New York. Northern Minnesota is an unregulated area when it comes to tattooing. Down here in the metro area, there are counties that have excellent regulation regarding the application and licensing of both the facility and of the tattooers. In northern Minnesota, we don't operate under that privilege. In Duluth, Minnesota, to operate a shop with proper sterilization techniques and proper biohazard disposal is a option, not a requirement. People are making assumptions that when they go into a tattoo shop anywhere in Minnesota that it is held to the standards that some of the tattoo shops in, say, Hennepin County are, and that's not the case. You walk into a shop, you're not only deciding what type of tattoo you're going to get, but you also have to make the decision whether or not the tattooist is capable of preventing you from receiving a bloodborne pathogen such as hepatitis. There's several tattooists here, and we've spoken to some over the past couple of weeks regarding amendments to this bill. And Representative Tao will speak to that. But we've been working diligently with folks. The intention of this bill is not to eliminate anybody currently tattooing. It's not to be punitive to folks who've been operating in the industry. And hopefully we'll proceed with the respect and input of those folks as well. However, for those of us who don't have the good fortune to operate in a county that can afford to regulate it, we are suffering economically as well as the risk of a public health threat. and that would be based, that would reflect all tattooists at this point, there being no regulation at this time. This bill is not perfect, and I'm sure that in the future there will be many discussions how we can strengthen it and create a better environment. There's discussions about age. There are discussions about industry standards that have been going on as far as ear piercing guns and other things. Those have been going on for decades. And there's advocates in this room that have been speaking to those concerns. Unfortunately, those types of things are have input from other lobbies that are much more powerful than we are. So it's the hope to set a minimum health guideline that's acceptable to as many people as possible so that the rest of the state, when you walk into a shop, you're not making that decision, am I going to get a bloodborne pathogen such as hepatitis or not? Mm-hmm. And I'm free to answer any other questions at the pleasure of the chairwoman of the committee.
As general background, and this to you or possibly to someone from the Department of Health to address these questions if you have any answers to, typically we would want to know, and this is part of why we ask these questions in the statute about the 11 questions that you provide some information on this morning, is first we want to know what are the levels of regulation that already exist. You've alluded to the fact that there are some county regulations, but not statewide. But there's different kinds of regulation addressed in this legislation. There's a regulation of the technician or the individual practitioner, but there's also regulation of the establishment of the facility, you know, all about the actual physical makeup of the facility, and then requirements for health and safety related to that. Could you and or someone from the Department of Health clarify for us, both for the individual practitioner and for the facilities, both federal and state and county or local laws or ordinance related to that, and also whether, you know, are there national or other certification bodies that certify practitioners in any of these areas currently, and we would need to have their standards, we need information on those standards. So do what you can to answer that, and then we'll have someone from the Department of Health, if they have any knowledge of any of those areas, address it as well. And related to that is, if there's harm being done currently, we would know by what means you know that, who currently collects complaints, you know, city, county, state, where is that data, who has that data. Because generally when we're talking about going from unregulated all the way to licensing, which is being talked about in this bill, we want to know, are there incidences of harm? How many relative to the overall number of procedures being conducted? And how do we know that? Is an important part of the information one would like to have in these circumstances. So let you start, and then if there are someone from the Department of Health or others in the room related to these professions that have knowledge of that, I would be interested to hear that.
Madam Chair, to speak to the harm being done currently, this is not a reactive measure in any means. This is an attempt to self-regulate the tattoo industry to prevent there being a public outbreak of some type of bloodborne pathogen due to tattooing. A statewide regulation would and licensing and inspection would protect both the establishment and the individual operators from people who operated outside of the law. Currently, there is no law in Minnesota. The county laws are based, Hennepin County has a public health facility inspection as well as a inspection of records and technicians themselves. And I can't speak for the public health department, and I won't try to. They're much smarter than I am. As well as there are some folks from the Red Cross Memorial Blood Bank here who have concerns. They can't currently accept donors who've been tattooed or pierced. Mm-hmm. And this is part of the health aspect that we're attempting to address.
Mm-hmm.
It would be our hope that tattooing in Minnesota with the state regulation would be assumed so safe and allow blood donors and those types of things. So there's currently not any harm being done, but there are things happening right now, such as I can't donate blood. My mother is in the Gallon Club, and I'm a tattooed person, so I can't donate at all. A state regulation would fix that. To speak to other regulations in the state, Minnesota doesn't have any operating principles guiding cross-contamination, sterilization of equipment, facilities, surfaces, any ways that the general public is exposed to bloodborne pathogens through the application of a tattoo.
currently you have to get parental consent to be tattooed under the age of 18. If we don't have any regulations, where is that coming from? And whoever is imposing that regulation, are they imposing any other regulations on any aspect of these industries?
Madam Chair, I don't have the statute in front of me, but currently I believe that Minnesota State says you only have to be 16 to get a tattoo. It doesn't say you have to have parental consent under the age of 18. That's another option that the tattoo operators in Minnesota have been taking on their own.
We passed a bill last year, and maybe council can refresh us as to that provision.
Madam Chair, Representative Root, I remember something being passed, but and I think it was in the criminal statute.
Well, I know from personal experience with teenagers that as of a couple of years ago, you had to have parental consent under 18 for a tattoo. So, because there was a request by one of my foreign students living with me to get one. So, and also even in some of the documents we received related to this bill, the statement was made that you currently have to get parental permission because somebody wrote in indicating they thought you just shouldn't be allowed to do it under 18. And so they were, you know, but the current law was with permission. So, anyway, that's a side point, but the point of my question was not about that issue. It was that if someone was regulating that, if not the state, who? My understanding was that was federal law, actually, the permission under 18. So, without the permission, that was my understanding, it was federal. So my point is, that means federal is doing something, if that's correct, so I don't know. But those are the kinds of things we need to know, I think, to do this kind of legislation. So it just indicates to me another gap in our knowledge about who's regulating what. Now, you refer only to one county as having both technician and facility regulations in place. I would want to know how those compare to what's in this bill, for example. And then I would want to know how many other counties have anything. And maybe it's the truth. I don't. If it's hard to believe we have absolutely no health and safety, you know, oversight of any of this in the other counties that don't have their own regulations. Could someone from the Department of Health, do you have any comments on this in terms of your knowledge of federal or county regulations to the extent that anyone is regulating this currently? Okay. State your name for the record and help us out to the extent that you...
Madam Chair, I'm Tom Hindlemeyer, Director of the Health Occupations Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. First, to state law, it's a criminal law. It requires a minor 18 years or younger to have written parental consent from both custodial and non-custodial parents, and it covers tattooing only, not body piercing. Since it's a criminal statute, it would be enforced by local police agencies.
And do we have no state health and safety for either facilities or individuals practicing even under the Alternative Health Practices Act, you know, 146, whatever it is?
Madam Chair, there's no state regulation. Some localities do regulate. St. Paul has an ordinance. Minneapolis, I believe, has an ordinance.
Okay. Can you just help briefly tell us a little bit of history in terms of whether previous incidences when, I mean, has there been previous attempts to regulate the health and safety aspects statewide prior to this?
There have been previous initiatives. Last year, the bill was introduced and had hearings on the Senate side, but not on the House side. I don't recall in previous years the introduction and hearing of bills to regulate body art.
And to your knowledge, do we have any data at the counties or anyplace else in terms of who would receive complaints about anything related to health or safety or even business practices, but you're the health and safety side, so in terms of if there's been problems or harm done?
Well, in those local governments that regulate, they then have a process for complaining to those local agencies about conditions. the Department of Health also gets reports of the spread of certain contagious diseases. We do know that there has been no spread of HIV related to tattooing activity alone. I don't recall information on hepatitis, and I'm wondering if Dr. Gorlin, do you remember what Rick Spinella?
Greetings, I'm Jed Gorlin, Medical Director of Memorial Blood Centers. There have not been any clearly documented cases of hepatitis B or C transmission in the last decade in Minnesota. There certainly have been nationwide.
Mm-hmm. Welcome, Representative Howe. We missed you. Hope your other bill went well. We were just starting with your first testifier, and he gave him an overview of the background, and we were just trying to get a little further information about what levels of regulation exist, state, federal, county, whether what the mechanisms for reporting incidences of harm are currently, if there are any. We're just trying to understand that a little better. Mr. Wells gave a general introduction, but given that is a first-time bill of this type, I think that giving us more detail on what it actually does, the sections in terms of regulating this industry and the types of practices involved in it might be helpful at this time, because that the actual bill content itself was not discussed in the presentation, or maybe you have other testifiers on that. I don't know. How would you like to proceed to describe the actual bill?
Mr. Buell is going to explain the technical parts of the bill.
Again, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I apologize for my ignorance and how these proceedings work, so I'll proceed as best I can. If you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt me. The initial section is for license of the establishment. In conversations with Hennepin County Health Department during the interim, since this bill has been introduced in the Senate, they had some concerns that were raised, and those were answered in the amendment. Okay. As far as the facility proprietary licensing between the county and the state.
Okay. We're going to pause there since you mentioned the amendment, and we have Representative Tao here now. We were holding off on the adoption of the amendment, Representative Tao, and the moving of it until you were present. So would you like to move your A1 amendment and then what the amendment is doing?
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, the A1 amendment, I think I would like to move the A1 amendment in the shape, I believe in the Senate this was adopted. Okay, I believe this was after the Senate testimony with the work, it was this is the product of the Senate committee, and this will be introduced or put into the bill in the Commerce Committee in the Senate. So this was prepared by the Senate to bring up to that point, to bring a bill up to that point.
And Mr. Wells, you were saying it addressed some issues brought by Hennepin County. Could you just, we actually haven't gone over the details of the bill that much yet, but just briefly tell what those issues were and how this addresses it, and then we'll adopt them.
Madam Chair, the amendments are after conversations with Hennepin County Health Department officials, county safety folks, and some industry input in addition to what we've worked with thus far in an attempt to answer concerns that industry people had about this bill being punitive towards people who are currently tattooing, facility regulation for people already in place, and some adjustments to some of the technical terminology to create a minimum health standard that was not vague. Mm-hmm. So. And I would be happy to address those individually if you'd like as well.
Do members have any questions on the amendment?
Representative Powell, line 1.11. Who's going to do these inspections? It says the commissioner, but is there a process already in place? How much is it going to cost?
This on the amendment?
The A1. Yeah. Is it the A1? I'm catching up slowly, Madam Chair.
And 1-1.
Mr. Chair and Rep. Emmer, my understanding is correct. These folks will be charged with a fee. And essentially, and the commissioner essentially is the board that will oversee this, and the fee are usually used to, I'm speaking as for a general term in many of the other licensing bills, that I don't think we'll be using general funds to do this. So.
Justin Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had one question on a definition of micropigmentation, please.
Micropigmentation has been used as a different term for tattooing for folks who circumvent laws in organized counties.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. I have a specific question in terms of this addressing some of the issues about facility regulation that I'm sure what's trying to be addressed by the amendment, which is they were talking about, you know, the location of the sinks or size of the area or types of surfaces that current tattoo parlors or facilities wouldn't necessarily meet these requirements under this, and they've been longstanding, existing for years and years. How, in what ways does this amendment address that?
Madam Chair, it specifically addresses the facility requirements in 2.26 through 2.31. The concern is that there are some buildings that are in existence that don't have the capacity to be completely optimal as far as a perfect world setting is concerned. That being said, they've been operating for decades with zero complaints and zero problems, and their standard is currently acceptable in their county that's already regulated, and we wanted to make sure that there was no preemption of any of those types of things. So they will be grandfathered in because they're already operating in a regulated county.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, in general, again, with licensing kind of theory, that there should be kind of a preemption in my mind generally against grandfathering things. And that's because if it's truly a health and safety issue that merits licensure or facility standards at a certain level based on, you know, evidence-based health and safety concerns, then grandfathering doesn't make sense. So I would have a concern that, you know, if what's being proposed in the bill is beyond the point that's indicated by evidence in terms of what's being asked for in post either facility or the technician, then that's something we should address in the legislation or in the discussion around it. But grandfathering, and then you also made a statement in reference to that in terms of, you know, they've been in business for years and there haven't been problems. I have no idea if there's been problems. We've just been told by the health department that if they did have problems, if it's a county-based oversight already, which Hennepin, you indicated earlier, was, then they would be the source of that data, and I have no idea what the data is. So I would hopefully that we wouldn't just be making decisions on claims that we don't know whether or not they're established by the evidence or not. I'm willing to, you know, go forward with the amendment, as this is the author's amendment on this, but it's, again, for committee members and in general, that whenever we see grandfathering, I think should raise some flags for us about what we're trying to do here and whether the other parts of it are legitimate or not.
Madam Chair, members, there are many bills where we grandfather a lot of folks in. The intention is to put the regulation, and as these grandfather establishments get older or they leave the profession and new tattoo artists or new folks move into the profession, that we start to standardize the profession. And so there has to be a point that we start. And if we don't grandfather these in, a lot of folks would have tremendous hardship. Jobs would be lost. Mm-hmm.
Representative Ruth?
Thank you. excuse me, Mr. Chair. And Madam Chair, I work as a nurse practitioner. I work in the city and in the northern suburbs, and I have a great appreciation for your craft. I see a lot of really interesting tattoos and body piercings, and I always ask my patients who did it. So thank you. I think it truly is an art form. My question is, And I know that in the amendment we have subdivision 8, and you talked briefly about we don't want to, if counties have a provision in place and they're a higher standard, we want to make sure that they're allowed to have that higher standard. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to review this. I don't know, maybe I missed it. I know one of the things, when I worked in the city, I would have tattoo artists that I had to perform tests on the tattoo artists. They had to undergo certain testing for HIV and hepatitis B and C, and they had to provide evidence that they were disease-free. Is that in here somewhere that I perhaps missed? And if not, maybe why you chose not to include that?
No, Madam Chair, Representative, that is not in the bill for several reasons. There are no other industries where a person's personal health, if mm-hmm. proper safety precautions are taken, is a condition of employment. So while I appreciate that concern, the safe application of tattooing doesn't lead to the risk of an exchange of bodily fluids between the tattooist and the recipient.
Thank you for that. When you crafted this bill, Representative Powell and the testifier, did you look, is there a great variety across the state and across the country? And I think Madam Chair was asking that question earlier as far as different provisions that you know that different areas have, and is there a wide variety?
Madam Chair, Representative, there's many states in the United States that do have regulations. In hopes of having an industry-friendly regulation as well as one that protects the public health, we work primarily with Hennepin County, which has had legislation that has been heavily researched by industry folks, and I'm not insinuating that this includes all of that stuff. However, as far as state regulation goes, this was the best we could do compared to how other states operated and how the industry inputted health Hennepin County. And there are some folks here as well that could speak to that much, much more well-informed than I am.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments on the amendment? Okay. And Powell renews his motion to amend the A1 amendment. All those in favor said aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
It passes. We'll move on. We only have officially 15 minutes left. I fear that the questioning may go a little longer than that later, but let's go to all the testifiers and get them before us. And Representative Powell, given the limitations of time, do you have any preferred order other than that that's on the list for testifiers? So we next have Jed Gorlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And given the time for testifiers, anyone coming up after this, if you could refrain from repeating information that's already been given and add to the testimony as appropriate with further information. Thank you. Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Jed Gorlin, Medical Director, Memorial Blood Center, speaking on behalf of Mayo as well, another blood collection establishment. We have Red Cross also represented here. There are two reasons to support this bill that has significant precedence in many other states that have licensing. By ensuring the single use of needles and single use of inks, it helps protect the public, and so there's public health issues that you've heard from Tom Hindlemeyer of the State Department of Health. The second is a rather unique aspect which Ryan Wells did address. If you have had a tattoo in the last year, we are required to defer you for 1 year from the date of that tattoo by AABB standards, which is the American Association of Blood Banks, which I just happen to be on their board. Now, the actual standard states that this includes tattoos or permanent makeup unless applied by a state regulated entity with sterile needles and ink that has not been reused. So the specific requirement does not require a deferral for a year in those states that have licensing bills, but does when there's only a county. So in fact, the blood centers are quite supportive of this because increasingly as we go to high schools and especially college drives, people are deferred, and sadly, once deferred, they often don't come back. So we support this bill.
Thank you very much. I think for the sake of time, can we go all testifiers and then come back to questions? I do have questions on this topic, but we'll go forward. Thank you. And we have Jeff Kaufman.
Thank you for taking the time to join us this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jeff Kaufman. I'm the CEO of the North Central Blood Services Region of the American Red Cross. And like Dr. Gorland, we support this bill because it frees up thousands of donors who are deferred for a one-year period because of that risk, potential risk for infection. For us and for Memorial as well, I believe the need for blood is constant, and we need the right blood at the right place for the right patients, and that saves lives daily. And so the ability to free up thousands of potential donors who would like to donate but are unable to do so, and as Dr. Gorland had said, typically they don't come back. We see these coming to blood drives, and unfortunately they are unable to donate. But they want to donate, and certainly they're not afraid of needles. So they've gone through that. I know that the piercing industry, the body art industry, supports this legislation because they want to assure the safety of their procedures, and we have both testified in support of this file. You know, I know there's concern from the committee's perspective about licensure in general. I think this is more than just licensure. It's an attempt to make the body art and piercing industry safe for an increasing number of persons who decide to get a tattoo or piercing, and the added benefit for the public is this additional supply of blood donors in a more timely fashion. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Since these two are on the same topic, and we'll probably go out to a broader issues again with the next two, any questions specific to this blood donation portion of it? I have a specific question, again, it may be for the Health Department, and Ms. Hittleman. If the question is in terms of regulation, is there any reason why the state could not regulate that all practitioners of either of these art forms, including physicians or chiropractors, other people who in their scope can also do some of these things, according to the legislation, be required to have single use and sterile, you know, meet the health and safety requirements that the blood bank process requires without doing licensure?
Madam Chair, one of the things that credentialing does, mm-hmm. licensure is a form of credentialing, mm-hmm. is it enables the authority to know mm-hmm. who is doing what, mm-hmm. where, and when.
Mm-hmm.
Without having, as part of the regulatory scheme, a method of identifying those establishments and those individuals who are performing the activity, it becomes more challenging or difficult mm-hmm. for the authority to enforce mm-hmm. The safety provisions that are in the mm-hmm. in the law.
Mm-hmm. The follow-up question would be, could we not require registration of all practitioners and then have the health and safety standards related to having to use sterile needles or what was ever required to meet the requirement of blood donation?
Madam Chair, the limitation of registration is that it's essentially voluntary, mm-hmm. except for those individuals who choose to use nomenclature, which mm-hmm. is restricted by the law.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as you see in the amendment, there is provision for micropigmentation,
mm-hmm.
And the reason is if someone doesn't call themselves a tattooist and calls themselves a micropigmentator, then they're not subject to the registration restriction.
Mm-hmm. And so are you seeing also things like certification takes it to the next step where that you can only practice it if you have that title, okay?
Madam That's Chair, mm-hmm. most of the nation uses the term certification in the way that we define registration.
Mm-hmm.
So Minnesota okay. registration okay. is essentially certification. But when we use the term and have certified regulatory schemes, it's much more like licensure than it is like just title protection.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions on this? Mr. Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quickly, where in statute do we say that if you have had a tattoo from a non-state licensed entity that you can't give blood?
Madam Chair and Representative Dean,
my understanding of the testimony we heard is that it's not in state law. It is a standard of a national organization.
The ABB complies with all federal regulations, which includes prescriptions against drawing blood from people who have had a risk of hepatitis. And so then the CDC defines the risk of hepatitis as bloodborne exposures, and unless you can prove that there's been single-use needles or inks, then it's a risk of bloodborne exposure. So there is not the exact wording that you have to be deferred for a year after a tattoo in federal regulations, in the Code of Federal Regulations, CFR, but it is inferred by the CDC that if you have a tattoo at an unregulated place, then you are at risk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, the how many of these bloodborne pathogens have we traced back to tattoo parlors in Minnesota? Does anyone know?
Just stay there.
Speaking with Rich Danella, he was unaware of any that were unequivocally associated with a tattoo. There are cases that are multiple risk factors that are just impossible to determine, but none in the last decade. But nationwide, there certainly have been.
Last question, Madam Chair, into the testifier. Do we screen for such bloodborne pathogens from the blood banks that are of donated blood material?
Yes, every donation is screened every time by multiple techniques, including antibody and molecular methods. The current risk of hepatitis B or C from a transfusion is thought to be less than 1 in 1,000,000 or two.
Mm-hmm.
On these topics, so in your testimony, you and from the Red Cross, it seems like your greatest concern that that in first being turned away, potential donors will not come back in the future. Do we have any data? Do you have any data, either of you, about how many people, you know, what percentage of your potential donors are being turned away because of this problem?
I can tell you at Memorial Blood Centers, that collects about 134,000 mm-hmm. whole blood donations a year, that we currently have at least 811 people on the current deferral list. Now, since we provide information to all recruitment sites that if you've had a tattoo in the last year, you will be deferred, there are probably two or three people not coming mm-hmm. to the drive knowing mm-hmm. that they would otherwise be deferred.
Mm-hmm.
So we suspect the number is actually much larger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, members, we collect about twice the amount of blood that Memorial does in the marketplace, mm-hmm. and as a result have similar statistics that show that several thousand of our donors have been deferred. But to Dr. Gorlin's point, we publicize that quite broadly, and people know that they can't donate, so they don't show up. We believe that that number statewide is probably in the 5,000 to 10,000 range mm-hmm. of individuals who would like to donate who have tattoos in the last year and who are not eligible to do so. And we know that that rate is increasing with the increasing popularity of tattooing and piercing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. We're running short of time, but I with Representative Towse and the members and those in the United patients, if we could go, you know, 10 to 15 minutes over. We do not have anybody else in this room till 10:30. Is that okay with you, Representative Towse, if we need the additional time?
Madam Chair, members, I think we're pretty much close to wrapping up.
Well, you have other testifiers.
Oh, then go ahead.
That I think are significant ones. So, Ms. Nolan, and why don't you both go up? Ms. Nolan and McCullough. Ms. Nolan, proceed.
Okay, Tanika's at a little disadvantage because being hearing impaired, we requested an interpreter and some listening devices. Uh-huh. But unfortunately, that didn't happen.
Okay.
So I think that I'll go ahead for us both, if you don't
okay.
mind.
Thank you.
My name's Elizabeth McCullough. I work for Tanaka Nolan and with Tanaka Nolan at Acme Tattoo. And we are one of the shops that have been in business for several decades with no incidences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm a little nervous.
That's fine.
Our concern is some of the things actually that you brought up about the fact that the physical requirements of this bill are somewhat prohibitive to existing shops and those people who might want to start their own small business. And there doesn't seem to be a correlation between issues of blood bank donation or disease transmission and physical establishment.
Mm-hmm.
I hear a lot about disposable needles, which is good, disposable ink, one-time use, sanitized settings, but that doesn't seem to be indicative of needing excessive square footage or sink issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so our concern from the industry standpoint is this is a lot of information that we got about a week and a half ago, didn't know that it was in the works, and now we feel, geez, this could jeopardize our ability to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't seem to be supported by a lot of outside the industry issues, like, you know, are we seeing incidences of infection? Are we seeing bloodborne pathogens? Nobody has that information, but we're making assumptions that it's affecting people's livelihoods. And it feels a little bit unwarranted at this stage. So although we certainly don't oppose legislation, we want to see things that increase the credibility of the tattoo industry.
Mm-hmm.
We also want to be, hey, we need a little time to digest this, and we need a little time to really think about what is it that's ensuring that diseases aren't being passed. I think it's more to do with the techniques that people are using when they tattoo or pierce, and less to do with the physical space.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in a nutshell, is kind of our first knee-jerk reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And we would like the opportunity to be able to talk to our representatives and to talk to Representative Tao and express ourselves a little more fully.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay. Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. My name is Tanaka Nolan. I'm an owner and operator of Acme Tattoo Company, along with my husband, Don Nolan. We have been in business for 21 years, tattooed thousands of people over the years. My husband, Don Nolan, has tattooed for over 55 years, myself 19. These are only a few of my challenges due to not being informed of this law until last minute, and have not had proper time to look them over, so that it safeguards the industry and protects the public. Tattooing of minors. The proposed law overlooks an issue that I feel strongly about. The tattooing of minors. Currently, a minor may obtain a tattoo if he or she has written permission from a consent. Most of the complaints that I hear about involve the tattooing of minors. I believe that the proposed law should require that tattoo artists cannot tattoo children under 18. It is too easy for a minor to fake a written permission slip from a parent.
Mm-hmm.
The problem could be avoided by simply raising the legal age to get a tattoo to 18. It is not clear that a release signed by a minor is enforceable. Generally, any contract signed by a minor is voidable and may be voided when the minor attains the age of 18. Generally, children under age 18 do not have sufficient judgment to make a decision about body art that will be with them the rest of their lives. Children's skin is not even growing until age 18, sometimes age 21. Children do not need tattoos, and the law should prohibit the tattooing of minors. The proposed law is anti-competitive. It makes it very easy for licensed tattoo artists to prevent others from joining the profession. Essentially, in order for an aspiring tattoo artist to obtain a license under the proposed law, they must find a licensed tattoo artist and ask to become an apprentice. Okay. Most tattoo artists will refuse because they do not want to make it easy for someone else to go into competition with them. Some tattoo artists might offer to sell the apprenticeship and say that they will only accept an apprentice if the apprentice pays an exorbitant amount of money. There are no other professions where the ability to obtain a license is under the direct control of people actively earning their income from the profession. The proposed law imposes unnecessary requirements. Think. Water is not used in the tattooing process. The requirement that, in addition to a sink in a restroom, a tattoo shop have an additional sink in the tattooing area is not reasonably related to tattoo safety and is not necessary. Hospital operating rooms do not have sinks in them because gases and germs can come up through the plumbing. The requirement for an unnecessary second sink imposes a financial burden on smaller tattoo shops that will have to install a second sink. The requirement for an unnecessary second sink makes it less likely that tattoo shops will be able to find space to rent. A second sink in a public area will require build out that a landlord may not want to pay for or authorize. Dimensions of a work area. The requirement that a tattoo work area be 45 square feet is not reasonably related to tattoo safety. This requirement would make it necessary for many existing tattoo shops to relocate. Partition of work area. The requirement that work areas be partitioned is not reasonably related to tattoo safety. There is no evidence that the requirement of a sink, a 45 square foot work area, or a partition of work areas leads to greater tattoo safety. These requirements impose a financial burden on the tattoo businesses. I look forward to working with all of you and the industry and Sly Tao. And you both. I'm sorry I missed everything that you said. And I would hope I would have an answer for you in all these years. So I thank you and make it a great day. If you have any questions, I don't know if I can hear you. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Oh. Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience that feels a strong need to speak today, but very briefly? Yes.
Madam Chair, may I respond to some of those concerns?
Go ahead, while he's walking out.
Three major concerns I heard, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Age, the work area, and the facility requirements. When we worked with the Department of Health to create this standard, those were their requests, and I don't presume to know what the cross-contamination requirements they are with looking for those rooms and sinks and those types of things. I do know that there needs to be sinks that are available to not to the public when you are disposing of water that has been used in the procedure. A cup of water, there are tubes, there are sterilization processes, and those need to be separate from a public restroom. And those are the concerns of the sink and such. As far as the existing establishments, there are provisions in the amendments to allow for those establishments to continue at the behest of the commissioner. So he can take a look at it, make sure it fits into what they're looking for as far as requirements for facility, and move on from there. Mm-hmm. On the topic of age, I completely agree that people under the age of 18 shouldn't be getting tattooed. That being said, if we're to put something like that in here, there are parents' rights advocates that would actively pursue this bill simply because we were removing the rights away from parents. So it was our intention to address one at a time the issues of tattooing, first to create an industry standard that would help legitimize tattooing and protect the tattooers from that, as well as giving us a platform to move forward to on things such as age and that. As far as licensing, tattooing is currently learned through apprenticeship a majority of the time, but a lot of these things are not, I am no longer in the industry, so this is not an anti-competition. These were licensing requirements set forward by Hennepin County and other public health officials that determined that these were requirements that they would like to see before they would license a regulation or a technician.
Mm-hmm. Introduce yourself, please, for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Representative Tao, and the rest of the committee. My name is Sean Anderson. I've owned Electric Dragonland Tattoo Studio in Hopkins, Minnesota for almost 15 years. I'm a tattooer with over 22 years' experience. I'm also on the board of directors of the Alliance of Professional Tattooists, which is one of our international trade associations. I have been a board member of this organization for almost 10 years, and I'm its immediate past president, a position I held for 4 years. I had been approached by Mr. Wells 3 years ago about his interest in passing legislation for the tattoo industry. Our organization, the APT, according to our bylaws, is specifically prohibited from putting forth new legislation on the tattoo profession. But we are allowed to ensure that eminent legislation is both sane and enforceable. I must stress that I've been given no position by the other shops in the state to speak for Minnesota, the tattoo industry as a whole. I am here as a concerned professional in the Minnesota tattoo profession, and I have a great interest in making sure that this law is written to serve the best interest of not only myself, but my neighbors as well. I was made aware of the existing bill in committee 2.5 weeks ago. Since that time, I feel that Mr. Wells and Representative Tao, with great help from the people at Hennepin County Department of Health, have made great efforts to work with the industry to make sure this bill serves not only the general public, but the industry as well. They have showed great interest in continuing to work with the industry to produce a well-written law, and have addressed most of my concerns over the contents of this bill. Most of the concern that I have heard from the rest of the industry in Minnesota is that they feel that more time may be needed to read the bill and adjust certain wordings contained therein. Also, myself and other shop owners have great concern about what the cost of the licensure will be. Most of our shops are very small. I only have 6 employees. And the cost is a very important concern for us. With the concerns that I have stated, at this time, this bill in its amended form has my initial support, and I look forward to working with Mr. Wells and the rest of the legislature to ensure both the needs of the public and the needs of the legislature are met. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak, mm-hmm. and I can answer any questions that anybody may have.
Mm-hmm. I think we're done with all the testifiers, so either to this testifier or generally on the bill, we'll open up for questions and comments.
Thanks.
Captain Immer.
First page, you've got an exception under subdivision 5. This is back where I was an hour ago or so. You've got the term board certified medical. Well, I mean, my experience is board certification in any particular medical specialty is something that comes after, it may or may not come. People may not seek board certification at any point in their career, so I'm interested to know why you picked board certified as opposed to licensed or some other measure.
Madam Chair, Representative, I can't speak to how the county officials came up with some of this language. I am by no means well-versed in the writing of bills, so we deferred to people who had more knowledge in that area when it came to exemptions and those types of things. When it was run by council, it was our intention to not go outside the tattoo industry. This was mainly to regulate tattooing, and a concern for the board-regulated folks was for events like chemotherapy, where they are doing some minor tattooing on individuals to mark that spot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think that solves it, though. I mean, you're gonna have some medical professionals that are licensed physicians in this state with years of experience that you will you'll be unnecessarily restricting their ability to do certain things.
Madam Chair, Representative Emmer, I think by board certified they mean people other than licensed physicians. They may mean dental hygienists, people that are doing the chemotherapy that are not necessarily received board certification as physicians do or attorneys do for advanced skills and knowledge.
Well, and I appreciate that, Madam Chair, Ms. Ace, but the problem is I'll give you an example. You've got a medical doctor who graduates from medical school, takes the licensing boards, passes. That physician is licensed to practice medicine in the state of Minnesota, but that physician is not board certified. There is a process that after a certain amount of experience and after additional testing, they can apply within a specialty. And while I understand if that's the intent, the problem is this can be interpreted to, for instance, there might be a dermatologist who is treating someone with a pigment condition, and they won't have a board certification. What's to stop somebody from saying that they don't fall within the exception the way it's drafted? That's why I read.
Madam Chair and members, I think in page 6 there's a list of exceptions of professions. So you know some other names you want to add to that list, then we'll be open to it.
Well, I appreciate that, Representative Towle. I don't like the bill. I'm not going to vote for it. I think it's a mistake. But I point that out. If there's something, if it moves on, I think there are some areas that you want to maybe look at and make sure that you don't unnecessarily exclude.
Advice well taken, Representative.
Thank you for that.
Representative Rude.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is along that same line, and perhaps Council can answer this. I know I work with providers who are they're optometrists maybe, and they do some of the permanent makeup for eyeliner. Would they be covered under this, or would they be... I don't know. That's something I think Representative Tell, it sounds like this is... A worthwhile attempt, and you have had some good testimony today, and I trust that you're going to continue to work with the community on this issue to make sure that there's agreement as you move forward.
No, members, as we move forward in this committee, usually you don't move forward unless we have buy-in from many folks. And I would like to continue to work with this piece of legislation. We could move forward, and let's say at the end, in May, nothing works out. I could commit to you that we could take it out.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions from members? Well, with regard to your last comment, Representative Tao, I'm going to put forward in a moment here just a very significant list of questions, and I don't know that we would have time to address them all in the next 5 minutes. And without them adequately being addressed and taking care of some of the issues in the bill, I'm concerned that we will not have the votes to pass this today. So I want you to ponder that. I think, and in saying that, I want to say I think there's definitely a bill needed here, particularly to have statewide regulation, a complete list of practitioners, and statewide regulation of all the health and safety issues required to make sure that people can will not be deferred from blood banks in any unreasonable way, and that we will not restrict the blood supply and addressing some, and also addressing just the basic health and safety issues about sterility and single use and all that. But what's being talked about here goes beyond that in many, many ways. I'm very concerned, first of all, about this apprentice situation that, this is normally people are licensed because they've gotten national certification, they've taken tests and exams, they've gone through established programs at colleges and universities and technical schools. None of that is going on here because of the unique nature of these practices, and therefore that's an issue for me. Secondly, there's what's called temporary events in here, and at these temporary events, you can have the technicians. You can also, I presume, probably have these guest artists as well. It requires those wanting to do temporary events, and I'm not sure what temporary events are, but I assume it's events possibly outside the tattoo parlor or the establishment. They're supposed to let the health department know they're doing these, but how these safety and health measures and water and sinks could be, if they're necessary at a facility, how they could not be necessary at a temporary event, I have no idea. Moreover, I'm concerned with the incredible regulatory burden that would place on our health department beyond even the basic regulatory steps required by the bill. If they have to go out and inspect the situation at temporary events, that don't have normal facility structures. I have no idea what the cost of the state protecting citizens under that environment might be. Then there's guest artists. I would need to hear a lot more about that and whether they meet all the same training requirements, supervision requirements. And then there's the 200 hours for supervision. Is that 200 hours actually performing the practice of the procedures, 200 hours in the studio or in the facility, sitting there watching others, or the course of 40 hours doing five procedures or five tattoos or body piercings and not, 50. There are just a number of issues here. So you can try to tackle some of those in a few months if you'd like, Professor Tao. But and the other question I have in the health department is we have absolutely no idea how many people do these things currently because there's no current associations. So I just heard of one association here. How are we possibly going to go about establishing the fee rate to know that the taxpayers of Minnesota are not going to end up experiencing some of the costs of this fairly extensive regulation? So if some of you would like to, so right now you can decide if you'd like testifiers to try to address some of those questions to the satisfaction of me or the committee, or you can decide that we can move forward in another way.
Madam Chair, members, that's a long, long, long list of requests, and it will take a long amount of time to get to that point. If the members feel this is a legitimate health risk to the population, then I say we move forward and we'll get those answers, those questions answered as we move on forward. But for me to try to answer that today, it would be nearly impossible. I'll need a quarter or a semester to get that done.
Because we are out of time, and I'm going to make one last statement, which is that my preference would be for us to table this and then get the additional information. I'm not going to make a motion to table it unless the real chair and the author would like to do so, but I do believe legislation is needed, particularly to address the blood bank issues and the sterility issues and the single-use issues and some of the others. But I don't think it's ready yet even to get past this committee, so I just put that out there for the author to decide which motion they would like to make at this time.
Madam Chair, I would request that we vote on it, whether to signal whether we need to move forward or not. So.
Okay.
Representative Murphy. Thank you, Madam Chair. And to members, I think I agree with the Chair that there is a need for the legislation. And it's only because we have such unevenness in terms of regulation. I would like to offer to be helpful to the chair, if that's possible, as you move forward, having a lot of experience with bloodborne pathogens, et cetera, and my experience in the surgical nursing. And I think that there is room to move, but I guess I would hope that we would advance the bill with space to talk and work through it rather than lay it on the table, only because I'm worried that we will time ourselves out. And so I from my perspective, and I know we do this often, this is going to go to another policy committee. There will be room for us to continue to negotiate it, and I think in licensing we all know that there are often times when we move things from this division to the policy committee when there's still work to do, and there's still room to do it in a policy committee. So I guess I would just like to make a pitch to the committee that we give this a nudge forward, expressing our concern that there's still work to be done. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to Representative Tao removes his motion to pass House File 677 as amended and move it to the Health and Human Service Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
So we have a tie, and I believe that means the bill fails. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, members.
The meeting is adjourned.